Yes. All right, yeah, I'm Paul Schaefer.
I'm Will Lee.
And you are watching the Letterman Podcast.
La 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 la.
Welcome once again to the Letterman Podcast. My name is Mike Chisholm. I am excited to host this show. I am excited for the guests that we have on here. And today is certainly no exception. The guy that we have on here is a guy by the name of Matt Larkin. Now, Matt he's had a successful career in television, all sorts of cool stuff. All right. It started with David Letterman. It started in the late years of The Late Show. And he came on board. He was an intern, became a page. And then, you know, as things were, you know, at a crossroads for him, he moved over into television. He always wanted to be in television and working for Tosh, working for George Lopez, and then working, getting into the production side of TV reality, cooking shows and things like that, like Top Chef. I told my wife that I got a guy who was a producer for Top Chef, and she was just like, her mind melted. She loves that stuff so much. But when I asked Matt if you'd be willing to come on the show here and talk about his love or his experience working for Letterman, I said to him, okay, you've done all this stuff in TV. Was your time at Letterman one that you would consider a highlight of your career? And he messaged back immediately saying that it was one of the best times of his life. And, oh, okay, perfect. Let's talk about that. And boy, do we ever. Lots of stories, lots of insight from inside the office building and the theater of the Ed Sullivan Theater. All sorts of very cool stories from Matt. I appreciate him like crazy. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Letterman Podcast, Matt Larkin. Matt, I got to tell you, when I got one of my favorite parts of the week is when I was going back and forth with you and you were like, okay, maybe I'll come on. Maybe I'm not sure yet. And I said, well, okay, did you enjoy your time there? And you said, I've been in television for X amount of years, all these years. And my favorite part of my television career was working for Letterman, that you loved it so much. As soon as you said that, I was like, this is going to be a really, really good podcast. I love that you're all the things that you've done in TV. I want to talk about that, but that you have this special place in your heart for this. You grew up watching Dave just like so many of us, right?
Yeah, I was a big late night fanboy starting around the age of 14. If you want to hear my origin story.
Absolutely.
it's a pretty good one. I remember the summer of 2000, I was 14 years old, and the show Survivor premiered on CBS. And my family and I were a huge fan and immediately hooked, like most of the country was. Yep. And I don't know if you remember, but in some sort of corporate synergy or a way to get viewers to tune into Dave, they would have on the previous night's cast off on the next night's Letterman show. Yes. And so that was what hooked me. I wanted to see the previous night's cast off, not really knowing anything about Dave or the show, but figured out, you know, at that point I was old enough to kind of stay up a bit later. And I remember tuning in and then just instantly being hooked by this acerbic wit of David Letterman, and how he wouldn't even have them onto the couch or in the chair. He would keep them off to the side and just roast them for like 3 minutes. And I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. And from that point forward, yeah, I was just a huge Letterman late night fanboy. And then, you know, started watching routinely. I put a television in my bedroom so that I could watch late at night, and was just hooked by the comedy and the guests and the musical guests. I mean, it all spoke to me, the New York of it all. I grew up in upstate New York, and so I always felt a connection to the city. And then just seeing how he would incorporate his staffers in always really appealed to me, and the interns. Yep. So yeah, as soon as I had the opportunity, I wanted to apply. And I always knew I wanted to work in television, but that show really spoke to me.
There's a gentleman who worked for CBS for almost 50 years by the name of George Schweitzer. He was in charge of marketing. He listening to the story about Survivor and how That's how you got in the synergy you're talking about. I'm going to send him that clip and he will grin from ear to ear. I promise you that.
Awesome.
That is so cool that was your gateway over to Dave. I love talking to folks who are younger than I am. And I love exploring the younger fan base, the people who came along, you know, into the Late Show run and became fans of Dave. I love that so much. So would you say that watching that, you said you knew you wanted to get into television, but clearly inspired by the show, The New York of It All, like you talked about. What did you want to get into? What were your original aspirations of getting into TV? What did you want to do?
Yeah, I mean, it was really, really anything. I remember I grew up watching Seinfeld with my parents every week, and they would do kind of I think season four, the show within a show where they shoot the pilot and a lot of the production that went into that. I remember also the year 2000, SNL did its 25th anniversary show. And showed a lot of the behind the scenes and broke the fourth wall a lot. And I was just consumed with what this production was and what it was to put on a show. So it was kind of, I guess, producing was always something I aspired to do. And then eventually writing as well, as I became more and more of a comedy nerd and got more into stand up. And I loved Conan and worshiped him as just a comedy writer and performer. So it was kind of a combination of the producing and writing. And there was a producer at Letterman named Matt Roberts, who I really respected. And he was great to me with advice and mentoring, and he had the perfect job to me, because he was both a segment producer where he would interview these A-list guests and produce amazing comedy segments and interviews with them, but then he was also credited as a writer. He would submit material and write material along with the writing staff, so some sort of hybrid there is what I always wanted to do.
Matt is a guy that I was just at an event in New York, and there was a whole bunch of Letterman people there, and Matt was there, and I chickened out. I wanted to go and introduce myself to him, but and it's so ridiculous, these little games that we play in our head, because if I know for a fact by reputation, if there's one guy who would be an enthusiastic greeting and welcoming presence, it would be him. But I chickened out. But he's a dream guest that we have for this show. Obviously, I'd love to have him on. I love that you were inspired by him and that he treated you well. When you talk about the idea of breaking the fourth wall, no wonder you would have gravitated to Letterman the moment you saw that. I mean, Letterman made stars out of so many guys and gals that worked for the union, that were production people of all different sorts. And having Joe Grossman on here, for example, that to me, I was so thrilled to have him on. Obviously, he's a writer and some of the things that he came up with and we explored that. But I'm starstruck because it's Joe and how many times he was on the show and the clever ways that they used Joe. Just so much fun. And that show in particular, I don't know if any other show has really done it the way that Letterman has done it. And since then, I don't think that there has been one either. Really, really cool. So I want to know, let's move down the origin story a little bit further. You knew you wanted to get into TV. Was this a university internship, that kind of a thing? Did you go right into a film school or to a technical school that had to do with television? Or did you go right into the workforce?
So when I was applying to colleges, obviously I had that in mind. I was applying to schools like Syracuse and NYU, getting waitlisted by some, getting kind of, Newhouse at Syracuse was like kind of the gold standard. And I got into the main school, but not into Newhouse. But ultimately, like so many of us, it was, the place that was cheapest that was the right choice in the end for me, which was the University of Vermont. Which really didn't have any sort of film or TV program. This is kind of funny. I originally went in as a communication sciences major, thinking that was like communications. And then when I got there, they were like, oh no, this is like for people like ASL and people with actual, communication learning disabilities. So
that's a kick in the balls right there.
I found that out the hard way at orientation. But I pivoted hard to the English major And I was always a fan of English. I was kind of that side of the brain, English and social studies more so. Yeah. And my mom is an English teacher, a high school English teacher. So grew up loving literature and film, obviously, and television. So all that. So I was like, all right, well, I'll go into English.
Yep.
And then my freshman year, they had a film minor, but my freshman year, they upgraded it to a film major. So if it is film and television studies, all of a sudden was a new major at UVM. And I just added that to my course load. And I actually did a double major in English and film and television studies. And yeah, had some great professors there. It was a lot more history and theory based. They didn't have much of a production setup, which was tough. So I guess that's how I knew, like, I would have to really get some on the job experience. And I didn't have any real film or TV world connections or feet in the door. So I decided, okay, I'm going to, my junior year was like, I'm going to have to really go hard after some internships.
Okay. So your junior year, and as you were doing that, is Letterman right on the horizon? Is that something that you kind of, you saw a through line? Like, I mean, we saw that as fans of the show. We saw these interns that would be featured, sometimes even on camera. You kind of knew there was a thing where that's a route. Is that something that was kind of part of the master plan from the beginning, or is this something that occurred to you midstream?
No, it was always on my radar. I always loved how we put interns on camera. And, you know, I think anybody who grew up around that time, now it's TikTok and YouTube, but back then it was like everybody wants to be on TV at some point. So there was some secret hope that I would get on camera as a Letterman intern. But also, if you go back to that time, I remember there being like publications, you know, college publications, whatever, would do reports on the best internships out there. For college students and kind of in any field, and always right at the top rankings was The Late Show with David Letterman. So
you're kidding.
Yeah, it was always like a highly ranked college internship around the time I was in school. So I was like, well, I want to work there anyways, and it's prestigious apparently. So let's go for it. And I applied for the summer after my junior year originally. Yep. Summer semester was always the most competitive because obviously just logistically, it's the easiest for kids to pull off.
Yeah.
I didn't get in that semester. I did get an internship here in LA with Sony Pictures Television in their development department.
Oh,
so
wow.
that was my first internship, which was amazing and really cool in hindsight. Cause at the time I remember they were pushing hard for this quirky, unique pilot they had just shot to get picked up. And it turned out to be Breaking Bad. And so I was there kind of for the genesis of Breaking Bad and many other prestige TV shows. And so,
I got to ask, what did you see when it came to Breaking Bad? What were some of the things that you got a chance to see? I mean, Jesse Pinkman say bitch? I mean,
so by the time I was there that summer of 2007, they had already shot the pilot as part of pilot season.
Yep.
And so it was just a screener. They were like, hey, Matt, go watch all the pilot screeners and, you know, type them up or, you know, do coverage on them. So I watched it and there was kind of this buzz about, oh, it's about a science teacher who decides to cook crystal meth. And like there's a whole sequence where he's in his underwear for half the episode. And it was just like everybody's mind was just kind of spun out by that. But I remember my desk was right outside the office of an executive named Chris Parnell, who now runs Sony Pictures Television. And I remember sitting outside of his office and kind of hearing these conversations with him on the network calls with AMC, begging for them to pick up this show, like just his belief in it and how he knows that there's magic here. And they seemed like they were kind of on the fence whether they were going to pick it up or not. But obviously they did, and it became one of the greatest shows ever. So it was cool to be in that world for all that.
That is very cool. I mean, obviously that's got to be a crown jewel highlight of the things that you did coverage on. Any other notables?
I just remember that at the time they had a show called Damages on FX that was it was great. I don't know how popular it was, but I really loved it and it was great. I was also a big fan of the Boondocks, which they produced. and were producing at the time. So they were, I mean, Zach Van Amberg and Jamie Ehrlich, they run Apple TV now, and those are some heavy hitters and power players. So it was cool to be part of that. And then while I was there,
and you're a 20 year old,
like that. I'm 21 years old, yeah, and wow. I'm staying with my aunt and uncle who live here in LA, and I didn't have a car. They were schlepping me to and from the Culver Studios lot every day, God bless them. And it was, but that was how laser focused I was on, like, I need to make this happen, and if I want to pursue this dream. And the people I worked with there have gone on to do amazing things in television. So it was really great.
Was there a job potentially waiting for you if you decided to kind of quit midstream and jump in? You hear stories about this kind of thing that sometimes happens. Was there a temptation ever to say, okay, you know what, let's jump in right now? Or did you know you were going back for your next year?
I think I could have gone back to Sony and started kind of on the assistant track and gone the development route. I think I did pretty well there and hit it off with all that whole team. So I guess just to recap, how it all led to Letterman, I then applied for the fall semester while I was there, And I got a call for an interview. I was here in LA doing the Sony internship, and I had to fly back to the East Coast. My mom took me to Macy's and bought me a suit for my interview.
Awesome.
My dad drove me down to Letterman. It was probably like a June or July. It was so hot. I remember it being so hot.
Had you been to the Ed Sullivan Theater before?
Yes. Good question. I had gone down to the city. My mom took me down for my birthday, probably about a year and a half before. And I was one of the rubes walking through Times Square who got recruited by what I later found out was a page just desperately trying to get people to come to the show and hand out tickets, and which is a job I later did.
Yeah.
And so I got a ticket to the show. And I think we had my little brother with me. He wasn't old enough to go, so I had to go alone, but that was fine. It was a dream come true.
Yep.
And it was an amazing experience and taping.
Okay, so you were somewhat familiar with the landscape.
A little bit, but the
marquee, that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. But then, you know, going up into the Ed Sullivan Theater office building is a whole different beast. And then that interview process to this day is the most intense interview I've ever had.
I can't wait to go through it with you. Who are the principals here? I hear that many times it's, you know, you got a point person and then you end up going to other department heads and things like that and having multiple people. Is that the treatment you got?
Yes, exactly. Yep. So the first person I met with was a woman named Janice Panino, who was the VP of Human Resources and ran the internship program, and amazing lady, was great to me for those years. And, you know, she so I had a kind of initial interview with her.
Yep.
And then, yes, to your point, then they run you through this car wash of probably six different departments and people that you're meeting with they're all kind of deciding if they want you, do they want to fight for you if you know, you get kind of through the process. I met with all those departments, research, talent. There was an 11th floor production internship, a 12th floor production internship. Writer's internship, which is probably the most coveted one.
Yep.
To work right in the writing department. Music and special human interest. I went through that. It was probably 3 hours that it took total, and they're just shuffling you along, and you're passing other candidates in the hall and kind of eyeing them up as you go along. So
do you remember some of the people who interviewed you?
Yeah, for sure.
Did Ryan interview you? I did not
interview with Shecky. Okay. Don't know that he got an intern. He was pretty much a one-man band.
Yeah.
From what I remember, but Ryan Williams was the human interest talent coordinator. I met with a woman named Jackie. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on her last name, but she interviewed for Talent.
Yep.
Kim Reynolds was Jerry Foley's assistant. So yep. She interviewed for 11th Floor Production. I met with the research team who Ben Fertig was a researcher. I'm still in touch with him to this day. I've been friends with him. And let's see, who else? Don Farina, I think, on the 14th floor for the writers. So yeah, they do a good job of cycling you through. And then from what I understand, it's, you know, they decide however their eight interns that they're going to bring in. And then each department kind of has to fight over who they want out of that group. And I ended up in the talent department, so which I was pretty happy with.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you do a phase of internship at Sony. So you know, you've had your foot in the door of production a little bit, that sort of thing. Did it serve you for that interview, or was it more just attitude and your first impression, do you think, that that got you the gig, or a combination?
No, I think having experience definitely served me, both in just getting the interview to begin with and then getting through the interview process and getting the offer. It seemed like they wanted people who, you know, had a clear passion for television, but also had some on the job experience.
Right.
And they didn't really care how big of a comedy nerd you were or how much you wanted to be a writer. It was more, is this someone who's going to be a good fit for the team here?
Right. Did they care that that you were an enthusiast of the show?
Yeah, I think that definitely goes far. But I think by that point, most of the candidates had expressed that in some way and were definitely fans and wanted to pursue that dream. Yeah.
How long between the interview and finding out that, hey, talent's interested in you, how long of a wait time did you have?
Oh, man, I would say probably a few weeks. I don't remember exactly, but
you go back to Cali. You go back to California.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Okay. So now I fly back on Southwest back to Los Angeles. I'm back. Everybody at Sony's rooting for me, and they know how big of a dream that is for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was probably a really tough couple weeks where I was just waiting for that phone call. And I don't remember exactly how I got word. I think it was a phone call now that I think back. And then by that point, it was game on. You know, they're sending you an internship packet with all the details and all this information of what you're going to need. You're getting a staff list where Dave's name is literally on it as the host. it was the coolest thing, and it was so exciting. And then, yeah, it was finished up at Sony, had an amazing time there, met Mel Brooks, who's another hero.
Wow.
Yeah, just incredible. Like Mitch Hurwitz walked through my office one day on his way to a pitch meeting. Like it was the coolest. And so that was great. But yeah, nothing could really compare to what I was in for leading up to Letterman.
Oh, no kidding. You've done such a good job of setting the stage. Now you get the call, you know that it's going to be happening. Do you got to do a semester of school in between there and then you're going, or like?
So I had finessed it so that by the time my senior year had rolled around, I had fulfilled all my requirements, all my course requirements, and that if I did have to go back to school, it was just going to be all elective courses just for the to max out the credits. But I figured out how I could finesse it so that I could get internship credit and just finish up my senior year that way. And so that's what I did. It was a mix of the internships and then had to do a couple online courses, which we had even back then.
Oh,
and
wow.
And never went back to Burlington, Vermont for my senior year, but I was already off and running. I was like, I've been in LA, I've been in New York. There's no way I can go back at this point. So
yeah, that's fantastic. I love to hear that.
So,
okay. Preparing to, okay, time to go to New York. Even back then, you know, Frank sang about it decades ago, if I can make it there, I can make it anywhere. Where did you, what part of the city did you live? What was it like? Was it student loans that got you there? Were you begging, borrowing, and stealing? How was the first? How was settling into the city, and how did that work for you?
Yeah, so they at some point along the way that summer they had connected us with the rest of the interns for that class, and yep. So I connected with the writer's intern, a guy named George Anagnostakos, and the research intern, one of the research interns, a guy named Doug Brady.
Yeah.
And we decided, hey, let's try and find housing together in the middle of Manhattan, which yeah. is easier said than done. We started out, we found this place on the Upper West Side that was amazing. And I don't know how we landed it. But we did, but before we could move in there, we had a couple weeks, at the show that we needed to kind of close the gap with. So we were all cramped into this very tiny apartment on the Upper East Side.
Yep.
That again, I guess we found things through Craigslist back then. So that, yep. That was the way. And then my parents were amazing with supporting me with the rent, and I had some, you know, scholarship money and kind of student loan money coming my way that since I wasn't using it for actual board and course load at college,
yep.
I was able to put towards that. Yeah, it was three guys cramped into, you know, in hindsight, it was actually a pretty big apartment for New York. So, we had a little roof kind of terrace area.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I miss that place a lot. I can't imagine what it rents for now.
Yeah. You know, I think you talk about living upstate. I'm Western Canada, and I mean, the pull of New York, the magnet that is New York. I think for just certain people, certain personalities, the pull of that city is the stronghold that it has on people's hearts, is tremendous. And you go there and how dense it is, how small the lodgings are, that sort of thing does not matter. The magic just covers it all. And I love hearing you talk with such fondness about being cramped as much as you were and finding the magic in that, finding the, you know, these things. So what month are we talking here? You're closing up this gap before you get into the Upper West Side apartment. What month are we talking here? What time of year?
Yeah. So just real quick, I just want to touch on your last point. But yeah, please. I mean, again, growing up in upstate New York, I was a giant Yankee fan. Awesome. So we'd go down to the city for games. I grew up watching NYPD Blues, you know, Seinfeld, of course, which took place in New York, SNL. So yeah, again, like you said, it's just this draw, this beacon that it was in addition to Letterman, like that was just a dream of mine on its own, was to live and work in New York someday. I love Broadway and musicals and all of that too. So, but yeah, so ultimately I think it was like the third week of August when we started, they had just come back from probably a 2-week summer break hiatus. Yep. So, yeah, then they threw us right into the fire.
How so? Let's do it. This is great. Yeah. How do they throw into the fire?
Yeah. So we show up, day one, they stuff us all into the 8th floor conference room, which is where human resources and kind of the administration floor was. Yeah. And we're all so nervous and just like not really talking to each other. Janice comes in and welcomes us, and she's
delightful, by the way. I've only met her in person once, and then we've gone back and forth, but from all accounts, just absolutely efficient and delightful.
Yeah, she's amazing and a true New Yorker as well. So you have to love that. And she's just so matter of fact with how she talks to people and lays things out. So she kind of came in and gave us her spiel. And I guess the two things I remember most from it are don't wear costumes on Halloween, because some intern had made that mistake once and Dave actually put her on the show to kind of roast her a little bit. And they just decided from that point forward, yeah, we don't really wear costumes to the office on Halloween or for any occasion. So they made that very clear since we were the fall semester. And then she also said, you know, you will see Dave in the hallways, and when you do, don't cower in fear. look him in the eye and say, "Hi, Dave." and because he doesn't want to feel like some monster that people are afraid of. So
I love that you're saying this. No, Matt, this is great that you're saying this, because so many times the stories get convoluted. It's a game of telephone, right? And then exaggerated and all that kind of stuff. Hearing it right from the horse's mouth here. It's not, don't ignore Dave. Don't make eye contact, all that, like the way that some narratives have explained it during your time there. Absolutely. Make eye contact, say hi to him, that kind of a thing. Don't cower. Love that you're saying this. This is great.
Yeah. And I, you know, I have worked on studio lots out here in LA where you hear the opposite. It's don't make eye contact with them. People have been fired for making eye contact with certain daytime talk show hosts who I won't name. But yeah, it was the opposite there. It was, you know, they, you know, don't, they was obviously with a caveat of like, don't corner him and sure. try to engage him in conversation, but yeah, definitely yeah. Just give him a cheery, hi Dave, and move on your way. And so that was really cool to hear as you're starting out.
I was talking to Grossman not too long ago, and he told a story about how, he got trapped in a stairwell and Dave was there and he didn't know what to do, that kind of a thing. There was that nervous thing. And I said to him, I live vicariously through stories like this. When I would hear these, even if it was conflicting, whatever, as you're talking about it back in the day, I was like, okay, if I was an intern there and I was crossing paths with Letterman in the hall, this is so, I'm such a weirdo. But in my teenage years, I was like, no, I know exactly what I would do. I'd be walking by him and I would just put my hand up for a high five. And if he did it or didn't do it, it wouldn't matter. That would just be a great moment. That's what I would do. I love that you're telling that you're talking about this, because I've heard this from other people, but there have been books written where they talk about how it's the opposite, how at yeah. at one point Dave had to actually, I don't know if it was Janice or not. If I have her on the show, I'm going to ask her. At one point somebody was told, hey, tell the staff to say hi to me, please tell them not to cower. And I wonder if this might be, you know, after that incident or whatever that caused that. It's great that she actually said to you, you know, don't let that happen. So you're in this meeting, getting assaulted with all of this information at once. Yeah. Excited the entire time. Like, are you on pins and needles, or is it fear? Is it numb? What's going through your mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything. It's, again, it's a dream come true. I'm in the Letterman offices about to do this internship I've dreamed of doing. So definitely excitement, but also so nervous. And, you know, again, they shove you in there with 10 other people you've never met before, and you're going to be working with very closely, very long hours for the, you know, next several months. And so somebody broke the ice at some point, and we kind of started to chat and get to know each other, which was great. But then, yeah, eventually they sent us on our way to our different departments. And what was cool was the previous semester's interns, some of them would come back to actually train us. So now they're showing us the ropes within our departments of the day-to-day and what you have to do.
And your talent, that's where you ended up at first.
Yeah, yeah, which I think is you know, also a very coveted department, because, you know, the guests are a big part of the show. And obviously, Dave would get the A-list guests. And so, it was a very intense department, but also one I was really proud to be a part of.
Is this where segment producers would have been under that umbrella as well? And that's yep. That's okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was a combination of talent bookers and segment producers, some of whom did both jobs. So, yep. You know, Matt Roberts was down at the end of the hall. Yep. Sheila Rogers ran the talent department.
She's almost number one. Like, my list of people, she is, I'm a huge music fan.
Yeah.
So Sheila is actually like I almost want her as much as I want Dave on the show. Like she is so impressive in what she's in her music knowledge and the shaping of that show and the music acts that were booked. I secretly want to do a second podcast called Live on Letterman that just focuses on the music. Yeah. And like, I'd have to love to have her as a co-host. Like she is, her brain is so impressive to me. And I really appreciate Sheila. So glad you mentioned her name.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, for a hipster like myself at that time, they were just having all the best indie bands on And that was a great era for indie music. And Dave's obviously a big fan of rock and rock music. So yeah, it was, that was also a cool reason to be there at that time.
Yep.
Brian Tedda was there. He's now the executive producer of The View.
Yep.
He did a lot of the sports guests and also a lot of the big names as well. Maria Pope was another one.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Sarah Billington was kind of the TV guest booker. She was great to us. Yeah, up and down. Everybody was really great, but it was also a department where you had to be on your game. Like, and I guess the best way I can illustrate that for you is the phones on the 11th floor. I don't know if you've heard about the phones.
A little bit.
Yeah. Especially on the 11th floor, I guess you've had Art on, right? From
a couple of times. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the 11th floor phones, that was kind of what was drilled into us as talent interns. All the interns would have to kind of do that at some point, but it was drilled into us that first day, like, you better get good at answering the phones and you better do it right. And if you do, you'll stand out. And if you don't, you'll get pulled off the phones and it's not the best look. So that was something I was like, all right, I know that I need to get good at answering these phones. And some may think like, oh, it's just answering a phone. What's the big deal? But
first impression, right?
Yeah, first impression. And also it was a massive switchboard of everybody on that floor. And so what would happen, and we were trained and everything by Becky Hagedorn was the 11th floor receptionist. So she trained us and walked us all through it. But it was, you would have three or four calls coming in at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what you would have to do is, within literally 1 second, prioritize those four calls based on the importance of the person receiving the call. So, so let's say three calls are coming in. You'd have to go late show, please hold, late show, please hold, late show, and then take the most important call, which was probably like Martin Short calling Maria Pope or something like that, which actually happened. So, or, you know, whoever that night's guest was calling in for their pre-interview.
Yeah,
we don't want to leave Steve Martin or whoever on hold or have their call drop. So it was this whole system, and I like to think I'm quick on my feet and can think like that in the moment. So I mastered the phones. I'm proud to say.
And during that time, I mean, I'm certain that if you're getting three or four at a time, you kind of don't have even time to process, you know, who it is that might be calling. There must have been other times though where you could process it. Okay, Steve Martin, Martin Short from Maria Pope, great. Any other notables as we're talking about the phones here? Any other notables that came in that were kind of fun for you?
Yeah, the other one I thought of for you, it was actually a hiatus week. So I later on I was a page. And I would cover the phones during hiatus weeks. They would pay me like a PA rate to come in and just, and the office was dead.
Yep.
Nobody was calling in, but I would cover whoever did call. And so that week I was actually covering the 12th floor phones for Art, and Mary Tyler Moore called. And
Jesus, royalty. Oh my
God. Exactly. And she called and she asked to speak to Dave because they obviously have a history together.
Yep.
And I had to explain we're on vacation right now, but I'm happy to take a message. And Mary Tyler Moore in her later years lived in this luxury condo building in Manhattan, and that condo building had a hawk that lived on some sort of pillar or something on the roof of the building. And it's actually a famous hawk. I think it just recently died. It was in the news and everything, but Mary Tyler Moore wanted to basically pitch a documentary to Dave about this hawk and its story. And so instead I got to hear the pitch for this documentary from comedy legend Mary Tyler Moore. So and she was so lovely and warm and sweet, and we had a really lovely conversation, and I took the message and left it for Dave. And I think I think she ultimately did produce something about the Hawk. I don't think it was with Dave, but yeah, that was a real passion of hers at that time.
That is so cool. The fact that you have this anecdote, Matt, is so, it's great. And I appreciate you sharing it with all of us. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. So talent department. Okay. Running the phones. What are some of the other things that, were you just getting coffee? Were you helping to prep pre-interviews and things like that? Like, was it everything in between?
Yeah, it was. So every morning there was a coffee run for the whole department.
Yep.
It's pretty standard. Then there was something called the morning report, which was myself and the other talent interns, who I should mention, Carrie Kemper, who's gone on to a great TV writing career of her own. The thing I learned there was that, and I guess I learned it after the fact, but they were very much an analog show in a increasingly digital world. Yeah. So every night we would have to set various VCRs around the office to record the next morning's morning shows on each, the Today Show, Good Morning America, the early show.
Yeah.
And then our first job of the day was to sit in intern alley, which was this basically storage closet where they shoved all the interns into. Yep. And we would kind of scrub through each morning show and create a list of all the chyrons or lower thirds headlines that were airing on the morning show. So, yep. And then we would distribute this massive packet with a bunch of other news stories all over the office. So every department got it. I really wonder how many people actually read it, but we did it nonetheless.
Writers read it.
The writers certainly did it.
A lot of writers definitely read it. Yep.
Yeah, the writers read it. I know Ryan Williams, the human interest coordinator, he would always come back and want a tape of some human interest story to potentially book someone. So yeah, it was great for obviously topical comedy.
Yep.
That was a big part of what we did. But I just remember, you know, we had to run it on just so many sheets of paper at the photocopier. The photocopier would get jammed constantly. We'd have to fix the photocopier. So it was kind of a headache at times, but also just some good mindless intern work at the start of the day. So
did you divide up the shows? Like, did you get Regis and Kathy Lee and so-and-so got the other ones, or was it a rotation?
No, exactly. Yeah. I can't remember how we divvied it up, but, I would take, you know, two shows and Carrie would take the other one into the conference room and scrub through it there, and we would get it all down on paper for everybody.
Your Sony job actually helped you out a little bit on that, doing coverage on these things.
And honestly, you know, my big part of my producing career has been something we call hot sheets, which is just another name for the same thing, but it's basically a report at the end of a shooting day of everything that happened that you then send to the network. So there's a lot of paper, a lot of writing, but yep. Yeah, I was well suited for it.
It all ties together. Okay. So that's a big part of your day right there.
Yep.
Then we move on throughout the day and what are some of the other tasks?
So then we would have to cover phones for lunch breaks for the receptionists. They would, you know, call us in to cover the phones. I don't think we ever had to make lunch runs. That everybody was kind of good about, you know, they wanted to get out of the office and go for a walk and get their own lunch. So that was never a big thing.
Did you go to Rupert's very much?
Oh yeah. I went there almost every day, and I was a big fan of Rupert's too. And still am. He was one of my favorite players on the show. And I would get a bacon, egg and cheese, and you know, some if it was the winter and I was kind of sick, I would always get a hot tea from there. So yep. Rupert was always great to me, and his partner as well. I know you've had him on quite a bit.
Well, it's not only that. I'm going to say it right now, because you know it's so weird to see the deli for sale and talking to Rupert. We have one sponsor here at the Letterman Podcast, one sponsor only. It's Rupert G and the Hello Deli. There has never been a time where it's more important for folks. The mugs, the caps, the shirts, all that stuff. Rupert is still the only official place that you can get Late Show with David Letterman official merchandise and Rupert G merchandise, and that I would even almost say the Rupert G merchandise might be eclipsing the Letterman stuff right now because it's for sale and there's stuff happening. And I'm not going to say what's happening, but go to hello-deli.com if you want to get any of this stuff. And for those in New York, like May just came back. I just saw her the other day, but not sure how long the place is going to be operational. So go back and do your pilgrimage. Hopefully they will have a little bit of a structure and there will be like a last month or something like that for people to go say hi, but go to hello-deli.com to get any Late Show with David Letterman merchandise or Rupert G Hello Deli merchandise. So there you go. Perfect organic way to throw them in here right now.
No, happy to help plug Rupert and May and the Hello Deli. And I had a Hello Deli t-shirt somewhere along the way. And, they were always really sweet to me, and I loved their food too. So yeah,
the food is good and it's affordable. Like it's a really awesome little soup and sandwich shop. It's so it's so great. Absolutely. So you covered the phones for lunch for people. You went out, had your lunch, that sort of thing. Then in the afternoon. Now we're getting closer to showtime.
Yeah, so yeah.
Was the tension going up throughout the day as you got closer to showtime, or were you immune to that because of the repetitive nature of things?
I would say I was immune to it just because everybody was immune to it, you know, that unless there was some big guest like a politician or someone where there was a little added tension, like it was so routine and everybody was so comfortable. And that was what I loved about it, was it's like you come in, you work all day, you tape the show, and then you kind of unwind, and then you come back and do it all again the next day. And I just loved that, you know, we in the business, we call it a strip show where it airs every night. But that was, I just loved that routine of every night, this is what we're doing. And so, yeah, so then as the afternoon kind of came around, kind of the coolest perk or job we had as talent interns was to put together the gift bags for the guests. So
awesome. What are we talking about? What went in those bags? Here we go.
Yeah, I mean it was pretty standard Late Show merch, a couple t-shirts, a mug, a hat, you know, nothing too fancy for, you know, George Clooney or whoever, but that was what we gave them. And and then, you know, the real perk of it was, I guess, as a way to have the interns, you know, get comfortable around A-list talent, we got to actually deliver it to the guests themselves in their dressing rooms. So
outstanding.
Yeah. So at the beginning of every week, Carrie and I would look at the upcoming guests and do kind of a fantasy draft of who each person would get to deliver the gift bag to, and pick our favorites. And and so that was the system we worked out. It worked really well.
And you know where I'm going next.
Who did I get to deliver?
Who are some notables that,
Well, I mentioned him already. So George Clooney was, I mean, you walk into a room with George Clooney and how can you not just be like, oh my God. Like,
cool as fuck.
Yeah, just cool and the charisma. Yep. And I remember that day we were throwing stuff off the roof. And cool. So I walked in kind of as that bit was happening, and he was watching it happen from his dressing room. What better vantage point as it's flying past? And I'm like, hey, Mr. Clooney, just want to thank you for coming on. We have this for you. And I hand it to him and he goes, oh, should I throw it out the window? You know, classic Clooney.
That's a good Clooney.
Yeah, thanks. So and I was just so starstruck, and you know, what a cool guy. I remember, again, giant Yankee fan, and right after he was fired by George Steinbrenner, we had Joe Torre on the show, and
I remember that episode.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So I got to deliver his gift bag, and I should mention another perk was that there was kind of this handshake agreement with the guests when they came on that they would autograph things for staff. And so we were included in on that. I probably abused that privilege a little bit, but you know, hey, I had to take advantage of it. And Brian Tetta was cool enough to get me a signed baseball by Joe Torre. It's been on my I'm looking at it right now on my bookshelf. I've had it ever since. So, yeah, he was kind of distracted at the time by whatever bit was airing, but, sure. but he gave me a nice hello and that was really cool. I have to say some of the cooler, friendlier guests were the rappers who you may not expect that from, because, you know, you might get intercepted by an entourage or their team or whomever, but T.I. was like one of the warmest people I've ever met.
Oh, that's great.
He like dapped me up and bro hugged me. Like he was so appreciative.
Just grateful.
His gift bag. And that was like the peak of his career too, or maybe just as he was blowing up, but he was really great. Will I Am was really cool when we had him on. And so, yeah, I guess I will say Dr. Phil was maybe not the warmest person I've ever met, but you know, that's okay. But we had some good ones, and yeah, I got some great autographs over that time, and that was a really good kind of training ground for, you know, becoming a producer.
Yeah,
where you have to be comfortable around talent and not, you know, be starstruck or, you know, unable to find your words. So
Dr. Phil, I think, gets a pass because you know, we just had was it Craig Thomas? I forget who it was that we just thought were, and they were the ones who came up with the Dr. Phil's words of advice. Sure. The ongoing bit that just was so good. And I can imagine that when, like, I remember the episodes where he would be on and he was kind of ready for war. Like he was kind of good to go there. I would think that his mind would be elsewhere. That is so charming. Love the idea that they are prepping you. They're giving you a life skill, as long as, you know, you can hack it. And I think most people would be able to, I'm certain there would be some that kind of got washed out because of that sort of skill, not being able to hack it. That's really neat that you were able to do that. Okay, so you made the gift bags. What would happen after? What would you be doing during Showtime? That's Showtime right there. I mean,
that was a big part of it. Yeah, we had to, you know, deliver those kind of before they would go on for their segment. During the taping.
Yeah.
It was really, after that, it was just kind of being on standby for anything that might be needed. The talent bookers would always be down there during the show on standby for the guests, and so they may call up and need something, you know, if a Band-Aid or anything that, you know, might be needed. So we were just standing by, and then after the taping we were just ready for anything that the talent department might need. And it was pretty quiet after that point. People started to go home, but we probably stayed in the office until 7:30, so a good hour or two past the taping, and just ready for anything that might be needed. So
during the show, when you would have one of the guests be part of some business outside, I think of, you know, Serena Williams, you know, with tennis balls outside or a quarterback throwing footballs into a cab, things like that. If one of the talent, Bill Murray, all of his intro, his entrances many times were very, big, the Beastie Boys, when they came in and they were performing, that kind of a thing, would you ever be called on to do something special because the talent or a guest was doing something special? Would you ever be assisting in that?
Nothing really comes to mind. That was usually, we had a great team of comedy producers who worked directly with the writers to produce whatever that was. So, and then, you know, again, that was maybe more of a production department intern responsibility. Gotcha. So yeah, that's not something I can say we ever really helped with.
That wasn't you guys. That was different.
Off the top of my mind. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now, how long did you stay in talent?
At the Late Show?
Yeah.
Well,
is that your entire, like, you, because you ended up in audience as well, right?
Yeah. Well, so I should also mention, I was a talent intern. I was dedicated to talent for that whole semester, that whole internship. I should mention, though, that because it's relevant. The writers went on strike in the middle of our internship.
Oh, you were there for, oh my gosh. You were there for that strike. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So, that was the fall of 2007. And, and having been in LA that summer, someone who took an active interest in the entertainment industry, there were already rumblings that it was coming.
Yep.
And sure enough, yeah, the first week of November, the writers walked out. So, So our internship, the tapings were no more after November, and we ended up. I'm sure you remember, but Dave.
Yep.
Dave was great and paid the staff anyways, and we kept coming into the office and, you know, would kind of work on whatever projects you might be able to muster up if you're not taping a show. But there are only so many ways to reorganize a filing cabinet. So
yeah, and it's not like you can write new material and things like that. That's what the point is. Right?
No, I remember, Jeremy Wiener on the week that they were about to walk out. I was at the elevator bank with him, and he was like, "Don't you effing scab?" As a joke, of course, but also serious. but yeah, there was no opportunity to scab anyways, because we went dark. The show went dark, and Dave was in full support of the writers, and we came into the office every day, but it was pretty bleak at the time, you know, because we were for us as interns, all we wanted was to be there for the Thanksgiving show and the Christmas show, and what better place to be at that time of the holidays. But unfortunately we were deprived of that a little bit, but it was, you know, historically it was looking back, it was kind of a cool time and cool to be a part of. We'd go picket. We would go meet up with the writers in Times Square.
Did you grow a beard too? Did you try and grow a beard?
I still am not able to grow a beard. So definitely was not able to back then. But we would go, you know, Bill Schaft was the strike captain. So we would go and just kind of walk the picket line with them in support. And that was, it was tough. I remember Brian Tetta throwing out there, like, what's worse, the writer's strike or the baseball strike? And we would have a big debate over that, as, you know, baseball fans who could remember the baseball strike. So, but, you know, at the end of the day, it was certainly a bonding experience. We played a lot of cards, a lot of card games got played. And we were constantly refreshing Nikki Fink Deadline, just constantly refreshing Nikki Fink for any information we could get. So yeah, really, really interesting. And now it's come full circle with the writers on strike now, of course. So yeah.
It's been fun to talk to some of the folks that I've developed kind of friendships with, and I've asked them about the difference between, like, I was at Steve Young's a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about this I was there for about 3 hours. We talked about it for 20 minutes. And the difference between that strike and the one going on now, and when they're able to go to different productions and disrupt production enough that they have to strike for the day, strike production for the day. I'm really grateful that right now, kind of on the eve of this AI and some of the things that are coming into play here, Craig Thomas came on and he did a really good job talking about this a couple of weeks ago. The idea that writing shouldn't be a side gig. You know, you look at you watching Survivor with your parents and having this through line, knowing that you want to be part of TV, and writing might not have been the thing that drove it like that, but we want to create something that kid who does want to be the writer and is really invested in it can go and do that as a career. And it isn't just some side hustle, and it isn't just some, you know, 5 week deal here. And it can be a real career still. The AI stuff, streaming, all of this. I really, really hope that we can come up with a really good deal for a long time. You know, and it's not just studios taking the next, you know, 10 years to try and figure ways around the deal, but it's something that everybody can benefit from it, because at the end of the day, we want more creative. I mean, I understand how AI works and taking other things and putting them all together and mashing them together for new ideas. Well, I want the people who are inspired by the muse, true inspiration, truly new things. And we need to foster an opportunity to do that. And so I'm glad that this came up today. Just support the writers, and we want the writers to, I know the Directors Guild, I believe, just I think they signed on. But if SAG, there's a chance that SAG could go, right? And if that's the case, then we got to figure this out before everybody comes back. Am I right? You're an industry guy, so am I full of shit, or am I kind of?
No, you're absolutely right. The Directors Guild made a deal, which was kind of expected because they're not the type to strike in historically. So
yeah,
that was expected. My brother is actually a talent agent out here, so he works with actors. And yes, they're negotiating now with SAG, SAG-AFTRA. We'll see what happens on that front. But yeah, today we're speaking, it's day 50 of the writer's strike, and it's crazy how fast it flies by, and unfortunately no progress has been made. So, but I remember back then you mentioned Steve Young talking about, he told a story about how he went into a Verizon store, I think, for a new cell phone, and he was looking at it, and all of a sudden some bit popped up that he had written, was airing on this cell phone that he was looking at. And he was like, I should be getting paid for this. And he was absolutely right. And they should get paid. And yes. Streaming has now become this massive machine and monster that, we have to make sure people are compensated fairly for that stuff. So yeah,
absolutely. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about this this point here. And Dave famously, I was going back and forth a little bit with Chef. I swear to God, I'm not trying to drop names. I really was doing this, and he talked about how when Dave made the deal separately, how good it was, because Dave could come on then and start hammering and actually how good it was as a thing. But back then, was it weird knowing that you guys kind of had this backdoor sort of deal done while others didn't have that? You guys came back earlier than everybody else.
Yeah. So I remember internship wrapped up without any fanfare because there were no holiday shows. There was none of that.
Yep.
I went home upstate, and you know, the plan I think for the show was to bring in the new crop. They had hired new spring semester interns, and so I was going to be going back to train them. And over that holiday break, like December 28th or something, deadline.com announced that Dave had made this interim deal that was going to allow us to come back. So yeah, there was some weirdness there, knowing that we were going to be the only show with writers, really the only project at all with writers. And that, you know, Conan and The Daily Show and everybody else was coming back writerless. So, but you know, we were just so happy to come back and to have the writers back in the building and to be doing shows again. So, I'll actually just I know we talked about souvenirs and stuff, but
absolutely,
since it's coming up now, I'll share it with you now. I kept the first script from our first show back after the writer's strike.
Oh,
and, I'll show it to you here. So I had to censor it a bit because there's kind of a naughty photo on the front of,
oh my God. All I want to know is what's under that.
Yeah, I'll tell you off air, but,
okay.
Basically, it's just imagine a writer, a male writer from the writing staff in a sensual pose in a lawn. And
tell me it's Mulligan. Got it. It's got to be Mulligan.
I'll tell you who it
okay,
is.
Okay. All right.
It's the caption. It says "Miss me," and so, and then as you can see, for every script, well, we had writers, but nobody else did. They dropped the W in the late show header to the bottom, and then it's like that's a writer kind of picketing. So it's kind of a cool time capsule if you'll indulge me, because the rundown here from it has the rundown at the beginning of every script was the show's rundown. So you know, it has obviously the monologue. Dave entered with 12 dancers with picket signs. And then they would do desk pieces. And then our first guest back was the late, great Robin Williams.
Yep.
I guess they did a cold open, I should mention too, which was Senator Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Written by the great Tom Ruprecht.
Oh,
and the line he wrote for her was, "For 8 long weeks, David Letterman has been off the air due to the writer's strike, but tonight he's back. Oh, well, it was good while it lasted."
Perfect.
Yep. And then let's see. So then they decided that even though we had our writers back, we would fill time with Get to Know Your Staff. So that was a segment we did where Dave would just bring on a staffer and interview them for the act 4 or whatever it was, act 6, actually. Lupe Fiasco was the musical guest. And then we taped 2 shows that day because, as you know, we would tape 2 shows on the first day of the week. So we had Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton in the first show. The first guest back in the second show was Donald Trump.
Wow. Yep.
And then more Get to Know Your Staff, and Shooter Jennings was the musical guest. So,
oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That would have been early. Oh my God, that would have been way early for Shooter.
Yeah, pretty exciting day.
Wow. There's a our long national nightmare is over joke somewhere around here, but we can't I can't nail it right now.
Yeah.
That is a hell of a way to come back.
Yeah, it was, you know, a lot of fanfare and you had to, because every show was coming back, but we were the one with writers. And I think everybody was kind of looking to Dave now as sort of a guide, since he was able to strike that interim deal.
You know, you were there during a time where there are certain periods where Dave became more the statesman, more the leader. Of course, 9/11 being a huge example of that. But there are other examples throughout his tenure where he became the guy that people looked to. He became the guy that would, say the thing that needed to be said through that sarcastic, wonderful filter that he had, the irreverent filter that he had. I think this is definitely an example of that. You got to see it firsthand. That's amazing. Knowing though, you're an intern, talent intern, there's a spring crop coming. You're going to be teaching them. Was there ever moments where it's like, shit, this ride might be coming to an end? Or did you kind of know already that there was some continuation afoot?
Yeah. Well, so I had it in my mind that since I felt like I had been deprived, right? Wasn't blaming anybody, but I felt like I had been deprived of
half. No Darlene Love for you.
Yeah, no, and exactly. And I was a big fan of the Christmas show, and the Thanksgiving show was where they usually brought interns on camera and everything.
Yes.
So I felt deprived of that half of the internship. And so I got it in my mind that I need to be a page. I need to go back. This is unfinished business for me.
Yep.
It was cool to go back and train the new crop of interns and come back and get a little taste of all that. But I pretty much insisted on an interview for the page program.
So, good for you.
Yeah.
I talked to Lee about that, and he talked about there's a lot of cool little adventures from being a page. That's a neat gig. And I'm certain you had fun doing it. Like, it feels like you were present the entire time, based on your recollection of things. And that delights me beyond anything, because there were, like I said, there were people from the other side of the continent who were living vicarious through you guys and gals. So, was it seamless? Basically your last day as an intern and then your first day as a page were,
right beside each other? No, I think I probably interviewed maybe as I was wrapping up the internship and training the new interns.
Yep.
And then there was a good 3 weeks in between interviewing, heading back upstate. Now I'm not going back to college.
Yep.
So it's, if I didn't get the page job, I didn't know what I was going to do. Probably come out to LA. But again, had that dream still of working and living in New York, and and knew my time at Letterman was not over yet. So thankfully they hired me in the page program. Yep. I was a terrible page. Let me just put that out there. I was not the best page. As you probably remember from attending tapings, the late show pages have to be the cheerleaders of the show.
Dave called it an indoctrination. The audience gets indoctrinated at one point. Yes. Yeah. No, oh yeah, absolutely. Yes. There's a system there. So were you direct under David Kay, or would it have been that it would have been Dave's department? Okay.
Well, yeah, David ran the department, and then Jennifer Ray was the page coordinator. Yep. And you as a page, you had to be perky and smiley, and you can probably tell I'm not really that type of person. I'm not the highest energy person. So I wasn't the best fit for it. There are other page duties. Again, we would go into Times Square to recruit people for the audience. I, always hit my quotas there and relished that opportunity.
I imagine that must have been an easy sell.
In the dead of winter when there's nobody out and it's bitter cold and or snowing, it could get pretty tough to hit your numbers. But yeah, of course, so many tourists coming through Times Square. We had to ask them a trivia question to show that they weren't totally, they had some knowledge of the show. Yep. And so, there's a whole process.
I apologize, Matt. Would anybody ever get on the gold list from that? Like, would you ever run into somebody who was like a super fan and be like, yes, and answer not just that trivia question, but the enthusiasm, the way they were dressed would be like, okay, we want this person and we want them on a gold list. Would that ever happen?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So I guess, it's a TV show, right? So yes. You want, it's a visual medium. You want things to look good.
Yep.
And you want things to look good for Dave too. Yep. So, if you stumbled upon, an attractive couple in their 20s or 30s who were well-dressed, that was gold. That was who you wanted, because they would get seated right up front, to make things look good. And so, we wanted them, but at a certain point we had to fill the theater too. So, you didn't want a crazy stalker who knows everything about the show either.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that's true too. Yeah.
That's the flip side of it, I guess. And then in that case, you might ask them a really, really difficult trivia question that nobody would ever get. For the most part, it was just like, hey, we need 50 people for the theater today. Like, can you go out to Times Square and find them? But, that was a cool way to just meet people. And we'd be out in the middle of Times Square. There'd be people, trying to fill comedy clubs, their audiences. The Scientologists were out there with us trying to recruit people. So,
never mind the Elmos.
They're right. Elmos, the creepy cookie monsters and everybody. So yeah, it was one of the tougher parts of the page job, but, a necessary one. And, you got extra hours for it. So that was cool too.
Oh, that's cool. By that point, I'm a nerd for the jackets. By that point, I guess you would have gotten one. You got them at Christmas time, right? Is that the?
Yeah. So we did get one for my fall internship, which was kind of up in the air. Would we be getting the Christmas party was canceled because we weren't gonna, do it without the writers. And but Dave was good about the jacket. So I'll show you the jacket I have here. This is from 2007.
Oh, I love that one. Yeah.
This is a good one.
That's great, because, and you must have loved that too, because it's got a little bit of a Yankee flair to it a little bit.
Yeah, baseball for sure.
That's a great one.
Very classic. And then I kept this too. This was the card that came with it, which was just a small envelope. And then it said, "Season's greetings, Dave Letterman." I always loved that he signed it Dave Letterman. It's like we're on that basis, I guess. And then I did get one the following year too. It's at my parents' house, but it just said pants on the breast.
Oh yeah,
the worldwide pants, and a little more subdued, but yeah, I was a sucker for those crew jackets too. I wanted them so badly.
I got seven of them. You're preaching to the choir.
That was just the coolest gift at Christmas time. So
yeah, that's fantastic. Okay. So how long did you stay a page for, and any other adventures? Because you had a rotation, right? As to if you were going to actually be in the theater for tapings and things like how many tapings did you see?
The
show's going, you're basically allowed to watch the show at that point.
Yeah, that was definitely the real perk of it, was we got to be inside for the tapings, because when you're an intern or a staffer, you don't get to be in the theater for tapings. So there were different positions.
That changes the entire deal for you. Holy cow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, yeah, because we all wanted to watch the show, and whether it is a stunt or a A-list guest or great musical act, whoever. So they would position us. And I guess for those who don't know, as pages, we were also kind of the ushers for the theater. So, you know, leading people to the bathrooms or, you know, seating people. So we would position ourselves throughout the theater and keep an eye on things, keep people off their cell phones, and keep people quiet if they were getting rowdy. And
did you ever kick anybody, or did you have to bring Mike or Vinny over to, you know, stop some?
Yeah, I don't think I ever had to kick anybody out, luckily. Perfect. But I was usually, again, as one of the lower energy pages, I was usually positioned in the balcony. So I was already with the riffraff up there. So, you know, it was accepted by that point. But the position that we ultimately figured out I was best suited for was seating the main floor as we loaded the audience. So, which was basically just a giant 200 piece puzzle that you had to solve in a matter of like 3 minutes. So, but I have a good mind for that sort of thing. Yep. And I was able again to like think really quickly. And, I ended up, you know, really excelling at seating the main floor as a page. So that was my bread and butter back then.
So moments that you got a chance to see, whether it's musical, whether it's any iconic you know, late show moments, things like that, there's got to be a bundle that you had a chance to see that time period.
The one that I always think back to, because they all kind of blend together at a certain point, I'll be honest, taping after taping. But I can mention a few. One was a really magical moment between me and my friends, where for the Christmas show, Darlene Love, Jay Thomas, which I always loved too. Absolutely. Rest in peace.
Lone Ranger story, absolutely.
Yeah. So for that show on that day, all of my friends from high school happened to be making their way into the city to make their way upstate for Christmas. And so I was able to get most of them tickets, and then I think maybe Bill DeLace had to sneak a couple into the theater for me.
I want to interview Chief so bad. That's awesome.
Yeah. However fantastic. We did it. It was a Christmas miracle. we all got inside, and then, you know, we all love Christmas. So it was just great to see Darlene perform, and then the snow coming down and the sax solo and everything. That was, and then I was on the main floor for that show as well, for once. And so I got to be there as well and take it all in with them. So, so that was great. And then another role I had at the show, I was a faxer or a freelance writer for the monologue. So, that was a couple months into
$75 checks there, Matt.
I got some $75 checks. And Steve Young, who we've mentioned, was kind of the leader of all that. And God bless him, because he had to take so many, pimply faced early 20 somethings, showing up at his office, knocking on the door, begging to be freelance writers. And he was always very diplomatic and very sweet about it. He would usually tell you like, hey, we're pretty full right now, come back in a few months time. Yeah. And which happened to me, but then eventually I went back and he gave me a shot. And Yeah, it took me a few times to get in there, and a couple months probably to get my first joke on. But
do you remember what it was?
Not only do I remember what it was, I have the cue card still.
That's great.
So yeah, so this is the cue card from it that Tony got for me. If you can see it here. And it's basically...
It's a Regis joke!
Of course, it's a Regis joke.
You wrote a Regis joke!
Oh. Yeah, so... and it's pretty cool because there's kind of a story behind it. They rewrote it at some point because there's like masking tape here. So they reworded it somehow. This don't cross here at the bottom, that was something new that had just been implemented, where Dave always used to go to commercial after the monologue. And then at some point they decided, you know, it was probably a strategy to keep viewers around. He wasn't going to go to break. He was going to throw to Paul and the band. Yeah.
It used to be say hello to Paul Schaefer, exactly. And then they would play him to the desk, but then they switched it to a commercial break. Yeah.
Right. So yes, exactly. I'm sorry. They had to remind him to not cross because he was going to do, I think, like great moments in presidential speeches or something like that. Nice. So the don't cross is there to remind him, but also that tells you that this was the last joke of the monologue, which means it was both raunchy and strong. So I was pretty proud of that. My mom framed it up nice for me, and it's hung on my wall. This is my prized possession. Like if I need to escape his apartment ever, this is coming with me. And so I was right outside. Unfortunately, I wasn't inside the theater for it when it happened, but I was right outside the theater I was like listening through the door and was able to hear it. And I was like, I think that was my joke. And called upstairs to the people who had access to the monologue list and the initials of who was credited with each joke. And sure enough, it was mine. So and my grandmother was a big fan of Regis as well. So it was all kind of perfect. So, yeah.
Do you have the clip?
I don't have the clip, unfortunately. Yeah.
No. Do you remember what date it was approximately?
July of 2008. It's buried in my emails somewhere, so
we'll figure that out.
We'll get that.
That's too special to not have. We'll try and figure that out.
That'd be awesome. I would love to have that.
That's a beautiful thing.
It was great.
How many did you get on, you know, throughout your tenure being a freelancer like that?
Probably a couple dozen. It was pretty rare, unfortunately, but the faxer list got heavier and heavier. And God bless Steve Young for reading all those jokes over that time. About probably a year and a half later, they ended up being like, all right, this has gotten too bloated, like we need to cull this a little bit and
streamline the list.
Yeah, and cut a lot of us loose. But you know, for that year and a half, I stayed up late every night and wrote up page of jokes and sent it in, and you know, refined it in the morning or added any stories in the morning that I could. And it was just a real lesson in comedy. I mean, you know, how can you beat that? Learning how to be concise with your jokes and brief and word things the right way, land things the right way. So
yeah, you're also paying your dues in an environment that is just like that. I'm a big personal development guy, and there's what you did, that exercise there. I mean, you got it on air. You win. But you know, at the time, you know, you might not realize that what you're doing are building skills that are going to serve you for the rest of your life, skills of tenacity, not giving up. Like that's beautiful that you did that outside of your position there. And I know a lot of folks there did, but it just says to me that is the quality of people that they were looking for these types of programs, these positions, and the show itself, Worldwide Pants as a company, such an excellent example of promoting people from within, people ending up being having these crazy careers in writing or executive producing, for that matter, with Barbara, you know, where they didn't intend on it, but they did such a good job of hiring from within and elevating people. So that is, that's really cool that you had that happen. That's
yeah. Awesome. And honestly, I should add too, you know, the day I got the call that I was being cut loose from the faxer list was one of the saddest days of my life, but it was also, to your point, such a good lesson in show business. Like, nothing is permanent in show business. And now, you know, I've been a TV producer for 16 years now, and I've had shows get canceled. I've had opportunities slip through my fingers for whatever reason. And, you know, just a lesson to not take things personally, and that those things happen, and you just have to, you know, take them as they come and use them to grow. So, yeah,
this is the bridge I wanted to cross to kind of finish the episode. But I want to make sure that we haven't, that we haven't finished mining some of the Page stuff there. Are there any other things as part of, how long were you a Page before you eventually, because that was your last position before you left, right?
Yeah, so the Page program was a year-long program. I did the full year, and I was there, you know, with the thinking that, oh, I'll be here ready to interview for any jobs, any staff jobs that come along. And I interviewed for a couple, and nothing ever worked out, but it was so hard. But the other thing, too, was that even though I had this dream of becoming a staffer and working my way up to writer or producer, everybody at the show was telling me, don't do that. Like, you don't want to do this. Dave's not going to do this show forever. And you're going to pay your dues. You're going to climb the ladder, and then Dave's going to retire. So go to LA, like, go West, young man. And that's where the opportunity is. And I was stubborn about it. I didn't want to hear that, but ultimately they were right. And so I hung around as long as I could, but eventually, you know, had to accept that, all right, that chapter's done, and we're going to move on to the next part of my career.
Would it be appropriate to give a shout out to anybody who gave you that that valuable advice? Was there any mentors there let's generalize it a little bit more. Were there any mentors there that you had that were staffers that you appreciated while you had your tenure there?
Absolutely. I mean, so like, in terms of that advice, Janice was number one. Like, she did not pull any punches with that. And she was right, as she usually is. Paul Masella, I was really close with, who ran the mailroom, and he now is the head writer of The Tonight Show, as you know. He and Chris Galetta, who is another great writer, they all said that to me. And again, they were right. You know, Matt Roberts, he did his best to try to get me some opportunities in New York. But ultimately, there's just not enough work in New York for what I wanted to do. And LA was where I had to come. And it was when I moved to LA where things really started to take off for me.
And I want to talk about that. Okay. I just want to ask this because we'll finish on. Were there any, when I asked you straight up during our text conversation that delighted me so much, I asked if you kept any souvenirs, and your words were, yeah, I raided that place. Do you still have more stuff? And if so, we're going to finish off with that stuff. And I want to talk about your trip to LA first, and then we'll finish off with the stuff that you kept.
Sure.
So you finish, and then did you know what you were flying into when it came to LA, or was it just, okay, time to go boots on the ground? I don't have any real contacts. I've got to just kind of start from scratch.
Yes. I should mention first that I stayed in New York for another year and was an assistant. Yes. I was an assistant for a talent manager there and learned very quickly that I did not want to pursue that side of the business. Just wasn't for me. Had great experiences, met some great actors, actually met Martin Short through that job, who is a hero of mine. So, you know, don't have any ill will towards it, but I needed to be in production. I needed to be working on a show. Yep. So I came out, April of 2010, I moved to LA. And it's so funny because after all these years of networking and trying to make connections, it was my best friend from high school who gave me my first job as a PA on Tosh.0.
Cool.
So he was the production manager on Tosh, and he needed a PA, and brought me on board.
2011, that Tosh was blowing up at that point.
It was the exact time that he was starting to blow up, and they were talking about him like being the new face of Comedy Central.
Yeah.
Over Jon Stewart and things of that nature. So they obviously had a hell of a run on that show. I did 3 months there as a PA. Also got to submit jokes for Tosh, and you know, it just kind of kept that ball rolling. That was such a fun show to work on. I mean, for anybody who's watched it would know. And then when I was at Tosh that summer, after a few months, one of the writers, and this is how the industry works out here, it's everybody word of mouth, like, hey, do you know somebody who'd be good for this? So one of the writers got hit up saying, hey, we're hiring a monologue writer's assistant for George Lopez's talk show. Do you know anybody who might be good? So he put me up for that, having monologue experience. And a writer's assistant job, as you probably know, is very coveted.
Yes.
So I got offered, and I really agonized over it, because I knew Tosh.0 was a really safe bet in terms of job security and where that show was going. But I also knew that a writer's assistant job is you just can't pass it up. So so I moved over to Lopez and worked for George over there. And then that's funnily enough, a month later, I was working with Robert Morton. So
I was going to ask if you cross paths with Morty or not.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Isn't he fantastic? I love Robert Morton so much.
Yeah, he's the best. And he the show was undergoing some retooling as I was getting there. And Morty was brought in as part of that and to run the show. And, you know, so I was geeking out hard on working with Morty, and you know, definitely relaying that I had been a part of Letterman, and so really loved working with Morty. He brought
he's a
me
hell
up.
Of a storyteller.
Oh, like, yeah,
stories. I could listen to him all day. And I mean, I told him as I was courting him for this thing, and finally he came on, and we've got a good little rapport, Morty and I. I wore jackets and jeans because of that guy. Like, seriously, he was one of the coolest motherfuckers in the whole world when I would watch him on Letterman back in the day. I love Morty, and talking to him, even like, yeah, they say don't meet your heroes. That's one that I met. Oh, he is so great and such a good storyteller and so many amazing stories.
Yeah, and it's so cool to like see him on his episode of Larry Sanders and
talked about that. He had the he had the American Television Award.
He's got it in his living room.
Give it back.
Got
it in his living room.
And he was great to me. He was always really good to me. He brought me on to a Tom Papa project after the fact, after Lopez wound down. And, you know, yeah, so he was great. And George was great to me, too. I can't say enough good things about George as well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. And what let's bring it to now. What are you doing now?
Yeah, so Lopez got canceled.
Yep.
Ironically enough, we got pushed out by Conan.
Because of Conan, yeah.
So I do like to mention that happened. And then it's the freelance TV grind, and the next opportunity that came along was on a competition reality show called Face Off, which was about special effects makeup artists competing against each other. So it wasn't exactly what I had been pursuing or dreamed of doing, but it turned out that they were having their own success at that point. And then there was a lot of room for advancement. So,
not necessarily what you were dreaming, but maybe realized or unrealized, or maybe at that moment you realized it, you were totally prepped for it. You were ready for that job.
Right.
You know, yeah.
And I should rephrase that, because what I ultimately realized was that the dream was just to work in television. I didn't really care, like, if it was late night or a sitcom or a game show Survivor, like whatever. I didn't really care. I just wanted to be in the middle of everything and be on a production. So, and that show was a hit and it was awesome. We made some great television and we ran 13 seasons on that show. So, you can't shake a stick at that. And, I cut my teeth there. I mean, that show is what made me a producer, because I learned all the skills of how to interview, how to edit, pre-production, I became so well-rounded there, that I can't say enough good things about my time on that show. And then that, you know, competition reality is a really fruitful part of television. So that springboarded me to shows like Top Chef and, so for the past 5 years or so, I've been working mostly in cooking competition shows. Yeah. I guess the thing I'm most proud of recently is a show called Fast Foodies, which was on a network here called True TV.
Yeah.
And it streams on HBO Max, now Max. Yeah. But it was, the reason I'm proud of it is because it was the perfect marriage of comedy and competition. And we were just kind of, it's a satire or a parody of the cutthroat pressure cooker competition shows. But we get to do a lot with comedy on it. And so we're very inspired by Letterman and shows like Eric Andre and, Adult Swim type stuff, where we go into post and we just totally have our way with it. So, very proud of that. And that's been a long, fruitful career for me ever since.
And I'm glad that we talked about that, because I'm going to go back to the beginning of what you said is, okay, well, you've been working in TV for a long time. But did you like your Letterman time? And then immediately, it's some of my very favorite memories that I had. And I love that so much. Again, we've had on this show so many of the different eras. And I mean, when you got people who, came in older at the beginning of late night. Mm-hmm. And then, you move, into folks who kind of cut their teeth in late night, and then they went off and did their own projects, the Simpsons or some of the other places that folks went. Folks who came in midstream into late show or at the beginning of late show, I should say. Different eras, from a baby boomer all the way down to millennials, who have been impacted somehow, some way in the orbit of what is David Letterman and company. I love talking to the younger folk who came into it at that point. It's so great to talk to you about this stuff. As we kind of bring it to the close here, you rated The Joint. What are some of the other things that you took from the Ed Sullivan Theater?
Well, I've shown most of them by this point, as they've kind of come up organically. This was my badge.
Oh, you kept the badge. So many people keep the badge.
Had to keep the badge. There's an intern one underneath this page one. So they just kind of plastered it right on top there.
Fantastic.
Let me see. I have excuse me one second.
Yeah, no problem at all.
I think you have a lot of these there, but this is one of the pencils. Yeah. So I have one of those. And then, just a lot of autographs. There's a Bill Murray autograph there, Jerry Seinfeld autograph there. This is a Jay-Z autograph here.
Wow.
Big fan of his. So
me too. I love the hip hop Letterman connection. And again, if we ever do this live on Letterman, there's going to be a whole bunch devoted to the idea of how connected Dave is to hip hop, how he gets, I don't know how he did it. We had Biff's kid on, Jamie Henderson, a couple weeks ago, and he's a huge hip hop fan. And we talked about it, kind of marveled at it, how Dave got this pass into the world of hip hop and how that world has embraced him the way that they have. So anyway, that's fantastic. So you met Jay-Z on the show.
I didn't get to meet him, but I think my co-intern got that, but what it was? I got intercepted by, that was one where I did get intercepted by the entourage. So, but that's okay. I understood. And he was nice enough to sign that record for me.
Fantastic.
And then, can I share one more quick story with you?
You can share as many stories as you want, man. We're good. We're into the good overtime right now.
Okay,
good.
So this is not a direct Letterman souvenir, but this is an FDNY t-shirt, ladder 8. And the story here is that during the writer's strike, there was nothing to do except for the occasional errand. And so one day the phone rang in intern alley. one of Dave's assistants. I picked it up. One of Dave's assistants called me up to the Dave Cave, which was Dave's office. And she was like, hey, Dave was walking around Tribeca this morning and some firemen down there saw him and, you know, shouted out hello to him. And he wants to send down some late show merch to them. So will you bring it down right there? So, right. So she's like,
that's the Ghostbusters firehouse, isn't it?
Exactly right. So,
oh my God.
So she's like, it's on the corner of Varick and North Moore.
Yeah.
So just go down there and drop this off to them. So I get down there. No sign of a fire truck or any firefighters at all. They're out on a call or something. But I realize that I look through the window, there's the Ghostbusters sign is hanging in it. And I'm like, oh my God, this is the Ghostbusters house. And, you know, grew up with Ghostbusters as you probably did too. So giant fan. So I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. But I also am like, what do? They're not here. I can't just like leave it here on the doorstep for them. So I hung out. It probably took 30 or 45 minutes for me to see their fire engine coming around the corner a couple blocks away. And they're coming back. And as they pull in, I'm like, hey, I'm from the Late Show. You know, Dave wanted to send you guys some t-shirts and stuff. And here they are. And they're like, oh, awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much. Hey, you know, we just went out and picked up stuff for lunch. You want to come up and eat with us? And so, I had to make a quick decision. Cause like, if we had been in production, I don't think I would have been able to say yes.
Right.
And even still, I was like, I don't know. They might not like it if I don't come right back, but the writers were on strike and we weren't filming shows. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to come up and have lunch with these guys. So I got to hang out in the firehouse with Ladder 8. They cooked an amazing meal. I think like sausage and peppers. I ate and watched daytime TV with them. They gave me a tour of the whole house, where they sleep, where they hang out, everything. Couldn't have been nicer guys. And you know, I have a lot of first responders in my family too. So that was really special to me. And then it was all, you know, took a picture with one of the helmets on and everything. And then to cap it off, I couldn't help. I had to ask, is it cool if I slide down the pole? they were like, yeah, go for it. And there's a whole technique that to sliding that you have to like propel yourself around it sort of. And really, I just kind of like ended up slowly
creeping down.
Yeah, a little kind of creep down it, but I mean that's still one of my favorite stories. This t-shirt's another one of my prized possessions. Like, yes. I wear it all the time, and all because of David Letterman and The Late Show. So, yeah,
That is a fantastic one. Cool. The inertia of the pole, you couldn't quite get it, but one day. Matt, I bugged you a little bit. And I'm so grateful that you succumbed to it. If succumb is a real word, that you succumbed to it. Thank you so much for doing this. I hope I feel like this has been so much fun.
Yeah.
I appreciate this very, very, very much. And the whole reason we do this show is, I have, for whatever odd reason, I'm compelled. I just had Tom Dreesen on again yesterday. And I mean, you know, he is that guy for Frank Sinatra. He's the guy who, you know, he's the flag bearer for that. I have a beautiful little granddaughter, and she is going to know everything about Letterman and what Letterman meant to the culture and all of that. I don't know why I'm compelled to do it, but I am. Every single one of these stories are fascinating to me. This has been so delightful. I just appreciate you so much. Anybody who has these little stories that you know of, you know, that might have kind of fallen out of the, you know, because they were only there for the folks who were there for 6 months, I want to hear their stories too, especially the ones who are attached to it in their hearts and their minds the way that you are with yours. Congratulations on the career that you've had. And, you know, I can't wait to follow what else is going to come from Matt Larkin in the next days to come and years to come in entertainment. But thank you very much for being part of this structure that so many of us find so dear to us. Matt, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate this.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Mike. It was an honor to come on and share these stories with you. So thanks for having me, man.
Amazing. We'll say our goodbye privately. I'll hit the stop right now, but thank you so much, Matt Larkin, everybody.
Thanks.
Overcoat and underpants.